Everybody's in your seat. By the way, I see some visitors. Glad that you're with us tonight. And one other announcement. We still need nursery workers for soul winning on Thursday night. It's getting to the point now where if you don't sign up, we won't be able to allow your child in the nursery. So if you're coming and putting a child in the nursery, you need to sign up to take the nursery sometimes on soul winning Thursday night. Okay, it's not free nursery while you go grocery shopping or anything either. I don't know if anybody's doing that, but just the idea is to share the burden of watching the kids so different ones can go out. Okay, lesson 25 in Hebrews tonight, looking unto Jesus. Probably one of the most familiar passages in the Bible, one to which we all refer often, because it's the best place to go to prove that the believer needs to have as his point of concentration the Lord Jesus Christ. You can only have one point of concentration at any given time. I've heard all this stuff about women being able to multitask and men can't. Men can't multitask and women are good at multitasking. Try driving behind a woman who's multitasking and tell me how good they are at it. And I think that's a figment of somebody's imagination as far as being better at it. We can all do some things at the same time without doing them any of them well, and it doesn't always matter. You know, you can walk and chew gum at the same time. You might even be able to walk and chew gum and rub your belly and pat your head at the same time, but it doesn't really matter if any of those things aren't done successfully. But when it comes time to really concentrate, like when you're working in an algebra problem, you know, or trying to solve some kind of a word problem, you know, like a brain teaser or something like that, pass an IQ test, you want to be at your fullest point of concentration. And to succeed in this Christian life, and as it's certainly compared to a race, that's unmistakable in Hebrews chapter 12. It's not the only place where it's compared to a race. And it's not a real common analogy, but it's an analogy that's used by both Paul and the writer Hebrews, as the Christian life is an athletic contest, and a race in particular. And if you're going to succeed in running this race, you're going to have a point of concentration. It can't be on the pain. It can't be on the knot in your stomach. It can't be on how little air there seems to be right now. Or how much your feet or your ankles hurt, you know, or the guy that's cutting up behind you, or the guy that's out in front of you, or anything other than one certain thing, and that's the Lord Jesus Christ. A few years ago, in an NCAA cross country championship, Riverside, California, 123 of 128 runners missed the turn. And somebody made a wrong turn. And everybody began to follow the guy that made the wrong turn. There's one fellow who knew the track and knew the course and knew how it was supposed to go. His name was Mike Del Cavo. And he stayed on the 10,000 meter course. That's how long it was, and didn't get deflected. And he was even thoughtful enough as a runner to try and bring the other runners onto the part of the course that he had gone on, you know. I mean, the first couple, hey, this way, it's this way. And he didn't stop, you know, but he had a lead on these guys. And so he, you know, just slowed down, kind of watched over his shoulder and tried to get him to come that way. Almost everybody, only four, followed Del Cavo. And nobody followed them after they followed Del Cavo. And, of course, those guys all did pretty well in the race. I don't know if there was anybody ahead of Del Cavo, but they all placed pretty well. But people asked him later, they said, what did your competitors think of your decision not to follow the crowd? Because the whole crowd was going the wrong direction. And they said, you know, what did your competitors think about you not following the crowd? And he said, they thought it was funny that I went the right way. You know, and at the time, I mean, the application is pretty obvious, isn't it? You know, and if you go the right way, somebody's going to think, ha, 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 he, he, ha, 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 dumb Christian, look at that dumb. But you understand when you get to the end of the race, it's going to pay off that you ran it the right way. And while the whole crowd's going off all together thinking, ha, this is great, we're, you know, and look at those idiots over there, there's a road that leads to destruction. And there's a way which seems right unto man, but, you know, it's the way of death. The point is obvious. There's a way we should run, and probably the most important thing about running is that you disregard the crowd when you do. And part of running the race properly is encouraging others to follow, even though you're going to be subject to their derision when you do. At the end of his life, Paul was able to look back over it and say how he had run his race. I've fought a good fight. I've kept the faith. Therefore, there's a crown of righteousness laid up for me, and so forth. If there's no spectators that you can see cheering for you, if there's no audible applause that you can hear, and if there's no tangible trophy that you can expect to grasp or obtain when you get to the end of the race, you're still supposed to keep running. And there's going to be plenty of opposition to running right, and there's going to be very little encouragement to running right. But wherefore, verse 1, seeing we are also, or also are, compassed about with so great a cloud of witnesses, let us lay aside every weight and the sin which does so easily beset us, and let us run with patience the race that is set before us, looking unto Jesus, the author and finisher of our faith, who for the joy that was set before him endured the cross, despising the shame, and is set down at the right hand of the throne of God. For consider him that endured such contradiction of sinners against himself, lest ye be wearied and faint in your minds. Ye have not resisted unto blood, striving against sin, and ye have forgotten the exhortation which speaketh unto you as unto children, My son, despise thou not the chastening of the Lord, nor faint when thou art rebuked of him. I don't know that I'll have much of anything to say tonight you haven't heard before, but we'll try to enumerate the things in this chapter and make a remark or two about them, and then we'll go home. But in here, with regard to looking unto Jesus or considering Him or running the race, whatever you want to title it, the issues are all the same. Yeah, the first thing is the witnesses that encompass us. That's in verse number 1. We're compassed about. And you know what a compass, to encompass a thing, is to go around a thing. And a compass, you got 4 points on a compass, and then there's 4 main points, north, south, east, and west, and then you've got all the other points on a compass. But a compass is a circle. And to encompass something is to draw a circle around it. And so the analogy here is very clearly to a stadium. And you're compassed about in a stadium. And there's stands and people in the stands watching you. And I suppose that every coach who ever coached has used one of the all these arguments. But here's some arguments that coaches use. And they're writing the verses here to try and get players to try harder. And if you ever had a coach or worked with a coach or been a coach, you've heard the coach say, look at what it did for the winners. You know, this is not in the game, this is in the practice. You know, but though you think, you know, I'm trying to think of the Michael Johnson. You think Michael Johnson sloughed off, you know, and ran like you're running? No, you know, he poured himself into it. He ran hard. Well, again, I don't follow modern athletics very much at all, so I don't know who's who, what's what, but I do remember him. And you can cite the name of this person or that person who's achieved something noteworthy in that field and say, look at the winners. Look at what hard work, look at what practice, look at what staying at it did for the winners. They've got the trophy. They've got the medal. They got the Super Bowl ring. They got the $1 million a year salary or whatever it is. And there he says, you know, compassed about with so great a cloud of witnesses. And we just finished with Hebrews 11 and in that great cloud of witnesses is all those heroes of the faith. Those who are named, those who weren't named, but all of them of whom the world was not worthy. We don't know all their names, but we know some of them were cut in half. We know some of them were exiles, wandered in deserts and caves, or wandered in mountains and lived in dens and caves and so forth. And, you know, they're the ones that handed the baton off to you. Whose baton are you carrying? You know, you start thinking about maybe like this thing right here, you know. Who handed you this? And maybe the last guy handed it to you, maybe he wasn't much, but somewhere back there, you understand, somebody bled over this thing to get it handed off to somebody, to hand it off to somebody, to hand it off to somebody, hand it off to you. Somebody bled for it. You know, Wycliffe bled for it, or Tyndale bled for it, or some Waldensian in the Middle Ages bled for it. Or some Christian in a Colosseum, you know, was thrown to the lions for it. And so what are you going to do about it? Now it's in your hands. You're just going to treat it like it's nothing important? You're going to regard it as the sacred thing that it is. They finished. They did their part. They handed over the baton. And now they're at the finish line cheering on their comrades. And they'd like to see you, you know, run the race successfully and hand off the baton to the next guy instead of just dropping it and going home in the middle. And, of course, the Lord Himself, and we'll say more about Him, but He certainly ran His race successfully. But there's another thing coaches say, and that is don't let your fans down. You know, your mom, your dad, your brother, your sister, your neighbors, your whoever it is that came to watch you wrestle or play basketball or whatever it is. Man, you don't want to let them down. They want to see you win. They didn't come to watch you lose. And, you know, there's some people that don't want to see you lose. They came and they're watching you to see if you win. Living saints, people over whom you have influence, or people who have invested in you, they want to see you win. You know, I mean, there might be somebody here who'd like to see me flop, but I'm looking over the crowd and I don't see anybody that I really believe that of. There might be people that aren't here tonight that would. I'm sure there are some, you know, they're not here now. They'd love to see me fly. But I think most of you that are here, you know, even if you don't like me all the time, you don't really want to see me crash and burn, destroy my life. I don't think it would do you any bit of good. I don't think you would rejoice in that. Because I've invested, and you stand up, I've invested in you. And you've invested in me too, by the way. But I have influence over you, and I don't want to see the people that have influence over me crash and burn. And I don't want to see the people that I have influenced crash and burn. The people I've invested. And the more I invest in somebody, the more it hurts me if they don't make it. You know, and so I've given them the baton, so to speak, at least for that stage of the race they're on their own. You know, I call his name. Probably wouldn't, I don't think it would hurt to call his name. I won't, but I could. But I had a close friend. And then several things happened one after another, and basically, I'm serious, the guy made about four major mistakes. I counseled him against every one of them. I mean, seriously, every one of them. I told him, I don't think y'all do that, and I don't think y'all do that, and I don't think y'all do that, and I don't think y'all do. And he got mad at me. We weren't friends for years, and then he called me back, and he went, a couple of years ago, you know, and put the friendship back together, and the friendship's grown in the last couple of years. We've gotten closer. And I'm not always right about everything. I know that. And I don't always stick my nose. I'm not one of these guys who sticks my nose in everybody's business, you know, and it's not the will of God for you. But in this case, I'm just telling you, he asked my opinion, and I'm telling you, he was wrong every single time. He shouldn't have done any of those things. I could just see it coming, you know. You don't have to have, you know, magic antenna that read the will of God. You can kind of see how certain things wind out. You've seen it before. And sure enough, we're going down this road. I know how that one finishes. I've seen that before. Don't do that. Did it anyway. Mad at me when it didn't work. Somehow I got the blame. After telling him, don't do that, don't do that, don't do that, don't do that, and then, can you help me fix it? And I tried to fix it, and I couldn't fix it. So I got blamed for not being able to fix it. Mad at me for that. But we're friends again. And I'm much happier seeing him doing well than seeing him, you know, just kind of in a corner feeling sorry for himself and mad at the whole world. Much rather see him like that. I have absolutely no pleasure in seeing him stumble and become kind of paralyzed spiritually. I had a lot of pleasure in seeing him get up and moving again. Those over whom you have influence are counting on you and cheering for you. And then there's some sinners too, by the way, that want to believe more than anything else that what you have is real. They're not convinced yet, but they want to be convinced that what you have is real. And they need a little longer. But they're watching to see. And then angels. And they're not a big issue, but, you know, angels, I'm sure, have helped us all through some tight spots. You drive like I do, they're going to be busy. We may not even be aware of every tight spot that an angel's helped us out of. I'm sure of that, too. But chapter 1 and 2, you know, Hebrews says a good deal about angels. This book tells us about as much about angels as any book in the New Testament, any book in the Bible. The only book tells us more is Revelation about angels and what they're all about. The first couple of chapters mention them several times. So I would think that in that great cloud of witnesses would be those ministering spirits sent forth to them who shall be heirs of salvation. And that's what they do. They're ministering spirits, minister to us. And so, you know, here's this angel, and God, you know, go sit on his fenders before he runs into that, you know, runs into that tree. And when he gets too close to it, just kind of push him off because I'm not ready to lose him yet, you know. Or what? And little stuff like, you know, and those things, they look out for you. They do things. God assigns them to minister to them, shall be heirs of salvation. You know, make sure he doesn't see that. Make sure, you know, make sure he doesn't pick up the mail today. That doesn't need, you know, he doesn't need to know about that. Just keep that from, you know, and little things like that that God uses angels for. And so they know God's invested in you and they spend some time on you. And they like to see you make it too. And then here's another one. Don't let those jerks on the other side have what they want. Amen? I mean, look at all those people over there, you know, with the other team's colors on. And they're booing every time you make a point, you know, and you don't want them to get what they want, do you? And again, now we're talking about a different kind of sinner, not the one who really wants you to make it because they want to see if it's real, and if it's real, they're getting in, but they're not sure it's real yet. This is the crowd that want nothing more than to see you fall so that they can say it wasn't real. And then there's a whole bunch in between. You know, they're just kind of watching you, but they're not persuaded one way or the other. And then the devil and all his imps, they want nothing more than to see you fall and fail. You don't want to let the other side, you don't want those jerks get what they want. They're watching, they're just hoping. And nothing pleases them more than to see you all messed up. Then the second thing is not only the witnesses that encompass us, but the wickedness that entangles us. In verse number 1, we're told to lay aside every weight and the sin which does so easily beset us. We'll deal with the sin first. Nothing is more likely to prevent you from running the race well than your besetting sin. And you know what yours is. And that's the one that you have the hardest time admitting or the hardest time getting rid of, one or the other. And it could be both. If you put it this way, you might admit it and have a hard time giving it up, and then you might not even admit it, and if you can't admit it, you'll really have a hard time giving it up. But whatever it is, it's your besetting sin, that thing that just don't go away. God, I thank God. I had plenty of sin in my life when I got saved, but the Lord took most of it away. But there's some things I've been battling 27 years, 29 years. You know, I mean, no problem with that. Over there, that's a battle. I've got to battle it, got to battle it. Why? Because I'm carnal. Yes, because I'm carnal. But not just because I'm carnal. No more carnal than you are. It's one of those things that God just leaves there just to remind you that you need Him. You know, and that wickedness, that sin, you have to just say, that's a problem I'm going to have, but it's not a problem I'm going to succumb to. I'm going to be tempted with that as long as I'm alive, as long as I got red blood and breathing, I'm going to be tempted with that thing, but I'm not going to yield to it. I'm not going to give in to it. I'm not going to let it take over my life. I'm not going to let it ruin me. Another possibility is, by the way, for the sin that easily besets us, he might be talking collectively, and the sin that easily besets us, judging by the context and looking back to where we just came from, that would have to be unbelief. What's the sin that most Christians, you know, and the polite, respectable, excusable sin that we don't even think is sin because it's so commonplace, and after all, it's not one of those dirty, yucky sins? It's unbelief. Just not believing God. Don't trust Him. Don't pray. Don't ask Him for anything. Don't believe Him for anything. Don't think He's going to do anything. Just kind of a negative, pessimistic, ho-hum, indifferent, worn out, complacent kind of an attitude. No vision, no hope, no zeal, no prayer. Unbelief kept Israel out of the promised land, and unbelief will keep us out of our inheritance too. Again, unbelief will keep you from even running. Because you'll say, what does it matter? God's not going to do anything anyway. And the third thing is the weights that encumber us. The idea there is to travel light. Weights aren't necessarily sins. You know all that. I'm just saying what you've heard before. Weights represent those things which may not in and of themselves be wrong, but they can hinder us from putting out our best effort. And if you know that it's getting in the way of you putting out your best effort for God, then even though it's not sin, it might be, it is best. I should say might be. It is best, just not having to do with it. At this point, the apostle probably does have things in mind like TVs, radios, CD players, certain types of clothing, amusements, hobbies, those kinds of things. You know, there's nothing wrong with playing golf. Yeah, I don't want to. I have no interest in the game whatsoever. I'm citing golf because it's something I don't do. So I'm not going to. You know, I could defend things I do, but I'd rather defend something you're never going to catch me doing. Because if I defend something you might catch me doing, you'll say, "Well, he just defended it because he does it." See, so I'll defend golf, which, you'll believe me, there's no danger of ever finding me in a golf course. So it's easy. I say I'll defend it there, and say I'm not defending myself. There's not anything wrong with playing the game of golf. He said golf is a beautiful walk, it's a pleasant walk in a beautiful meadow destroyed by a little white ball. And it has no appeal to me. Somebody told me once that it does have a kind of a built-in addiction because the next hole is another chance, you know. And so I don't know if you get a buzz out of it, but I could definitely see the addictive component there. And I'll do better on the next hole. I'll do better on the next hole. I'll do just like put another quarter in the Pac-Man, you know. And that kind of thing, that stuff gets me. So I don't want it for that reason. But as far as the playing of the game, you know. But I think it's probably wrong for somebody to play 18 holes of golf every day. You know, not do anything for the Lord. I mean, not go soul winning, not teach a Sunday school class, not read the Bible, not pray, and all those kinds of things. But to get time for all that golf, I don't think that's right. No time for their family. It could become an obsession. Playing putt-putt or going to the driving range or swatting baseballs or lifting weights, anything like that. It can all be, it can all be an obsession. Some of it in moderation is fine, but then it can get to be where it takes over. And when it takes over, then it's a weight. And again, I think everybody needs some recreation. I really honestly do believe you need some recreation. But we overdo it. Then it becomes a weight. Again, the idea is travel light. Don't have anything in your life that prevents you from doing your best as a Christian. And overwork can, but we're probably not inclined to overwork. Then you have number four, the winner that enamors us. And of all those good examples in Hebrews 11, and he must have given us those to encourage us. I mean, he didn't give us those for no reason and say, forget about everybody. You know, I just told you about all those great heroes of faith because I really don't want you to think about them. I really want you to think about Jesus. You know, and I don't know why I told you about them, but I wrote it, so I'm not going to tear it up and throw it away. That's not the point. There is some encouragement to be gathered there, but your point of concentration can't be Moses. Moses can be a reminder of somebody who humanly ran the race. Gideon can be a reminder of some human being who ran the race. Joseph, Abraham, all the others in the chapter, or somebody just like you with all the stuff that you have to deal with, they have to deal with, they ran the race, so if they can, you can, but they can't be your point of concentration. Not looking unto. You remember them, you know they're out there, you know that they handed you the baton. But as much as I might admire Robert Murray McShane, I can't make Robert Murray McShane my point of focus. Or Watchman Nee or anybody else that's gone on to be with the Lord. I can't make them my point of concentration. My point of concentration has to be the Lord. And He's a better object of concentration. I can find fault with all those people. I mean, I know their faults, but if I studied about them long enough, I'd find one. They all endured a great deal, all those heroes in chapter 11, but He endured the cross. You say, well, some of what they endured, you getting sawn in half sounds pretty uncomfortable. You know, as bad as the cross is, really, I mean, you know, and I'm not trying to minimize the cross or be light about, you know, I think what I said was kind of funny, but I'm not trying to have levity with regard to the cross, but you understand, getting sawn in half wouldn't be any picnic. Sawn alive, you know, or torn apart by a lion. I don't think I can get into that. But you know, the thing on the cross wasn't just the physical suffering. It says He despises shame. It doesn't say endured the cross, despising the suffering. He endured the cross, despising the shame. And that was the tough part of the cross for him. It wasn't the physical part. I mean, that'd be tough on anybody. Nobody would just get through that. But it was the shame of the cross, not the suffering of the cross, that was the real difficult thing for the Lord to endure, because, again, He was carrying on Him all our sin, every last one of us, all our sin, from start to finish in our lifetime and everybody else's lifetime, all of that. Undeserved, He's bearing it. It's on Him in such a way that His fellowship with the Father is broken. All the sin of all the world, His burden. Again, however graphically it's portrayed, the physical part of it's portrayed in the Passion of the Christ. And I appreciate, again, anybody that confesses to murder or whatever. You know, you heard about the one guy, right? When, you know, he went and saw the Passion, came out, confessed to murder, and somebody told the cops where the body was. I'm not being funny there either. I appreciate any effect like that it has on society. If it helps to make the world a little cleaner place, that's good. But that's not the real suffering. Even that doesn't portray the real suffering. The real suffering was something in the supernatural beyond what yours, eyes, or mine, or our minds can even comprehend. There's no part of the race He doesn't understand. He's been through it. He's covered every inch of it. He did the whole course. He knows which direction to take in every fork of the road, and He'll mark it out clearly and wave you in the right direction if you need it. And it was by looking unto Him that we're saved in the first place, wasn't it? I mean, as Moses lifted up the serpent in the wilderness, even so must the Son of Man be lifted up. Look and live. You know, that hymn that's based on that idea there in Deuteronomy, you know, where the Numbers, you know, where they saw that serpent of brass, all those that had been bitten, and when they looked on that serpent of brass that Moses had made, they lived. We should look, first of all, on His person. Look unto His person. Again, as author and finisher of our faith, you know, instead of thinking about how you've been mistreated, think about how He was mistreated. If you were mistreated for Him, remember He was mistreated for you. You might have been mistreated just because you were. But if it was for His sake, it's easier to bear. I find it that way. I mean, I really, honestly, as a Christian, if I'm mistreated for Christ's sake, it's really pretty easy. When I'm mistreated because I'm short or because I'm old or because I'm, you know, that stuff bothers me. You know, and then I'm wanting to make somebody spit teeth. But when it's for the Lord, I can take it. I just shouldn't want to make anybody spit teeth for any reason. I'm just saying it's easier to take it for, you know, for His sake. Consider His person. Look unto His person. And it's, you know, and again, if it helps to build you up, if it helps to make you humble, if it helps to make you call on Him, then that's for His sake too. You know, we see it for His sake. You know, this is because you're a Christian. This is because I don't like you. But the because I don't like you is the Lord's behind that too. Tearing something down, something about pride or something in you, He wants out. So you look to Him, look on His person, perfect. Find no fault in Him. People attack Him, people deride Him, people mock Him, people criticize Him. People humiliate Him. People attack Him. Did He fight back? No. Not one time. Never spoke a cruel word in derision to anybody. Instead of thinking about how you've been mistreated, think on His person. His perfect person. Philippians 4:8. Everybody's memorized it. Nobody lives it. Finally, brethren, whatsoever things are true, whatsoever things are pure, whatsoever things are holy, whatsoever things are just, whatsoever things are good report. I don't know if I got it right, but I got most of it in there. If there be any virtue, if there be any praise, think on these things. Who thinks on those things? I don't know how many people I've told. I don't know if anybody's ever done it, but I don't know how many people I've told, you know what you need to do? You need to get yourself a couple 3x5 cards, and on one of them write Philippians 4:8, and then on the back of that, you need to make a list when you're not mad, and when your stinking thinking isn't going on, and you need to write out some things that are true. And then write down some things that are pure. And write down some things that are just. And write down some things that are holy. Write down some things that are of good report. Write down some things that are honest. And keep it with you. And when your stinking thinking starts up, pull that card out and read it and think about that stuff instead. Because, when your mind starts working in crazy ways, it runs on a particular track. And it's not going to jump that track and go over to right thinking unless you retrain it to do that. And you can't retrain it to do that if you won't even take the time to write a few things down on a 3x5 card. And so you, for all those years, your mind's been running in the wrong direction under pressure. And you get a little bit of pressure, well, there you go. Oh, and I can't stop thinking all these crazy thoughts. I can't stop thinking all these suicidal thoughts. I can't stop thinking all these angry thoughts. I can't stop thinking all these lustful thoughts. I can't stop thinking all these hard, having all these hard feelings towards my spouse. Yes, you can. You just hey, lazy, get the 3x5 card out, write the verse out, think some for a while about some positive things, and keep it with you everywhere you go. And when you start that stinking thinking, quit wallowing in it, pull it out, and think on it. Or could you just write Jesus, but I understand that that's a glib thing for me to say. I mean that. I'm sure it sounds sarcastic, but just to write Jesus on there probably ain't going to do it. He has to be your point of concentration. But you can think on things that are holy, true, just, you know, and other things besides Him. Just train your mind not to think in a wrong. And again, Jesus first and foremost in all of that. The weariness that encounters. Oh, we're not done. Looking on His passion. His passion was the joy set before Him. The passion of the Christ wasn't the passion of His suffering. It was the passion of His joy. And again, did you catch it that He despised the shame, not the suffering? He welcomed the suffering. Because in the suffering, He was paying for our sins. He was passionately joyful about paying for your sins. And then we should look on His position, because now He's on the right hand of God. Sat down on the right hand of the throne of God. That's why the oneness people can't be right, because you can't sit on your own right hand. Well, you can, but you can't be, you know. not in the sense that it's being used here, you know. He started the race, and He's there at the finish line with the rest of them waiting for you and cheering you on. But there's something else in verse 3, 4, and 5 is the weariness that encounters us. And this is kind of a segue. That's a broadcasting term. A segue is when you move from one thing to another thing smoothly. You know, it's not an awkward transition to get from the commercial into the program, or, you know, it's the segue is to make a smooth transition. And the segue is into the subject of God's discipline of His children. And that's in the next several verses, down about verse 15 or so. And it's a natural kind of a segue, because God disciplines us as His children, so that we'll have the discipline later on to stay in the race when we get weary. The point is, you know, here these guys, they finished their race. Jesus finished His race. Keep your eyes on Jesus so you can finish your race. And if the Lord has to chastise you, realize that He's disciplining you so that you'll have the discipline to finish the race. That's the order of the arguments here. Because later on, you're going to get weary in the race and you're going to want to drop and say, I can't go any further. Satan's main tactic and goal is to wear out the saints, according to Daniel 7:25. Just to wear you out. If he can just wear you out, he's done what he needs to do. That gets you to stop as well as anything. And you've not yet resisted unto blood. We should read verse 3. Consider him that endured such contradiction of sinners against himself, lest ye be wearied and faint in your minds. Ye have not yet resisted unto blood, striving against sin. You haven't bled yet, but Jesus bled plenty. And by the way, if you haven't bled yet, why not? I know we're speaking in metaphors, but the verse is probably talking about martyrdom. I get that. I'm not blind to the fact that martyrs bleed, and he's probably talking about, you know, nobody's trying to kill you yet. They might be laughing at you, but nobody's hauled you off to a concentration camp. That's probably the tone of it, but there's certainly an application to runners, because I hate runners. It's one kind of physical activity I really never did do very well at or like. Actually, I used to have pretty good wheels, but I never enjoyed running. It was just bored running. Shin splints, you know. Runners, but I know enough about running. Runners get bloody feet if they go far enough. And runners get bloody noses and bloody knees and bloody elbows when they fall. And none of those things would stop even a nominally dedicated runner. I mean, you don't have to be, you know, any world-class runner. I mean, even a guy in training. You know, but he's dedicated enough to be preparing for some race or in a race. He's actually in the race that he prepared for. And if he falls and scrapes his knee, you think he's going to sit on the sidelines and go, "Oh, I have a bloody knee. Oh, I didn't have a raspberry on my elbow. I think I'll go home now. I don't want to run the race anymore." No, you know, gets a scrape on his face, you know, or tooth, you know, stumbles and falls, tooth goes through the lip, you know, and the lip's all and blood run. He'll just keep running. He'll dry up. Any runner with any dedication at all would keep running over the blood that a runner sheds running. Are you with me? He's talking about running. And what makes a runner bleed? Well, stumbling. Right? That's about it. Stumbling. Or again, you know, or just the wear and tear on the foot. But you get a chance to... There'll come a point where you can stop running and it won't bleed anymore. But that's about the only... It's not like the kind of bruises that you... Or not the other kind of wounds that you can get in other kinds of physical endeavor. Some kind of... If you start bleeding during some things, you better go home. You better call an ambulance. But not a runner. When a runner bleeds for something that a runner bleeds over, he can keep running. And it shouldn't stop him. But what does it take to stop you? Christian. You know, as a Christian, what does it take to stop you as a Christian? Something analogous to a runner bleeding, or has it got to be tougher than that? You see, once you're defeated in your mind, you've lost the race, right? Lest you be weary and faint in your minds. At the end of verse number 3, we wrestle not against principalities and powers, against the rulers of darkness of this world, casting out imaginations and every high thing that exalts itself against the knowledge of God, bringing into captivity every thought to the obedience of Christ, that this mind be in you, which is also in Christ Jesus, being the former of God and so forth, though not robbery to be equal with God. Your mind will wear out before your body will, if you don't train it along with your body. And you can wear your mind down with negative thoughts about yourself, negative thoughts about other believers. I'm not trying to give you a lot of Robert Shuler stuff here tonight, but just say, if you tell yourself you're a loser and you're never going to make it, you're probably right. And you can tell yourself you're the best at what you do and you're going to be a millionaire, and you probably won't be. I'm not saying, you know, to think all that positive think and grow rich stuff, it doesn't work, okay? But I'm telling you, to think negatively and derisively about yourself will prevent you from accomplishing anything. So, yeah, positive thoughts will not produce anything directly, but positive thoughts will help in the continuation of the things that will produce positive results. Thinking about Jesus, thinking about pleasing Him, thinking about the end of the line, thinking about running the race well, thinking about being able to say, "I finished." You can't win just by telling yourself you're going to win, but telling yourself that you stand a chance of winning and that you stand a chance of going further while you're practicing and while you're racing will help you to finish. But if you tell yourself you don't stand a chance, you don't stand a chance. And renewal of life comes through renewal of mind. You have to renew that mind according to Romans chapter 12 and verse number 2. "You've forgotten the exhortation which speaketh unto you as in children. My son, despise not thou the chastening of the Lord, or faint when thou art rebuked of him." Remember, and we'll talk about these things next time. We'll get into the following verses. But the weariness that encounters us is something that the Lord has chastened us beforehand to prepare us for. He's put us, you know, all those little things. Why is the Lord letting this happen to me? Why is the Lord letting that happen to me? Bill Gothard had a saying once. He said, "God will let you stumble in the shadows so that you can run the race successfully before the watching crowds." All that stuff we complain about and say, why does that have to happen? And why? It's because the Lord's chastening you, and you shouldn't despise it because He's getting you ready for the race. He's your trainer, see, and He's been through it. He knows what it's going to require to finish. And we only think we know what it's going to be, what's required to be prepared to run the race. And He says, I know exactly what it takes to run this race, and you ain't ready yet. I wonder if any of us are even in it. You ever think about that? Are we in the race now, or are we still in the getting ready to run the race? Are we still in the training for the race? You say, well, if you balk at the training, don't expect to win. And some people just, really, they quit before the training was over. They never even got through the, I think you can go run the race now stage. So this training's too hard, and there's no way I'm going to be able to run the race because I can't even finish a week of training. And so they, too much for me. I'll just make money and have fun in this life, and then heaven will just have to be what heaven is because I'm not interested in getting ready for it. You don't want to be that way, and neither do I. All right, let's close in prayer. And don't forget, there's a choir rehearsal right away in the fireplace room. No, right up here, right? On the platform, cantata rehearsal, okay? Father, we pray that You bless us tonight, Lord, with the ability to stay at it and finish well. In Your name we ask. Amen.